sight, and soon I sailed the seas of sleep, where ancient shadows slither in the dark and deep. My goddess was true, and a nightmare came true. The mirror of my night, faithfully she lies upon me. In my darkest hour, she is there. A religious light, lustfully she goes down on me. In her eyes I see the fire's flare. The mirror of my night irritates me now. She rides me like a mare. I slide in her.
there's some conspiracy. Crucified for no sins, an image beneath me, lost within my plans for life. It all seems so unreal. I'm a man, couldn't half heal this world, left in my misery.
Belong to me at last. Through all those complex years, I thought. Good evening, my Volk, my people. We're here again, my last stream of the week, and I get to hang out with all you awesome people. Whitman, thank you so very much. He dropped a no-no and said, we'll have to catch replay later. Stay airy in mind, Volk. That's the plan. Once you go white, you know you're right. As in white power, that is. Oh my gosh, it is so good to see everybody here. That was the band Tear. I mean, they're pretty selling them. I'm sure a lot of you have heard of them, but for anyone who hasn't, they're actually from the Faroe Islands, which are right off the coast of Iceland, and they're fucking incredible. I'm not a big fan of covers, generally speaking, especially Iron Maiden, but funny story, I actually heard their cover of Where Eagles Dare before I heard the original. It's the only acceptable Maiden cover ever. Also, I know Pantera is a big favorite with everyone, but again, that cover, there's just like an extra depth to the tone. And I'm sure that came in with production, just a little extra polish. Amazing. It's just amazing. Amazing. So how the hell is everybody doing tonight? Hump day, right? So we're going to have a fun time tonight. Who all is hanging out with us right now? So over here on 88, we have got Aryan Eagle, Kermy, and Tango Alpha Vector. And there's probably a couple people lurking. Hi, lurkers. Anybody listening on Crewbot? Good to have you listening along, you busy white people. You awesome Aryans over here on FTJ. So far, we've got Filthy. We've got Brother Whitman. Of course, the Commandant, Aryan Eagle. Newly knighted ninja Thomas E. Dwyer and our froggy brother Kermy pulling double duty as well in the chat. So, and again, so anybody lurking, hi guys. Good to have y'all. So, Ash and Ether, episode 43. That one's like crazy to me. We're actually rapidly coming up on a year of Ash and Ether, which means I've probably been streaming just about a year overall, which is insane to think about for me. Most of my early stuff was lost. That was on a different platform. We're not going to get into that whole thing, but not for too much longer. I think it'll be a year here on FTJ as well. So, fun times. So, this week, we are doing the Weavers of Weird, the Norns. Most people have heard of them. I know if you've watched any of my Ash and Ether streams, I bring them up fairly often. They're some of my favorites, personally. But we're building on a theme here over these couple of episodes. There's going to be at least three. So last week, we went over all the different ancient Scandinavian concepts of fate, basically. So you had Weird, you had Orlog, you had Haminja, and you had the Filja. Okay, so this week we're building on that. So now we understand the different threads of fate, so to speak. Now we are going to look at those that weave those threads, who impact them, interact with them, and can change them. Fate, our ancestors didn't really see it as, I mean, it was fixed, but not fixed. They love that dichotomy, that liminality, duality, whatever you want to call it. Things that end in E. So. Let us get into it. So, as I said, you know, last week we went over the different threads. Now we're going to go over the Norns. Let's see. 5 minutes. I actually remembered to print my notes this week. Let me put up a picture, actually. I wanted to share screen. Because it's just so fucking badass. Aryan Eagle made that one. Hey, Woodsman, good to see ya. Good to have you here, brother. Oh, slash, throwing an actual. But yes, that is the based Aryan Eagle channeling pure Vril. So we'll have him up on the screen hanging out with us. Okay. So, as I said, we're going over the Norns, the Weavers of Weird. So these are who pull at the cords that bind gods, mortals, and actually, technically, the very cosmos itself. You know, whatever your beliefs are on all of material creation, and as far as who created, how it was created, etc., we all agree it's there. And, you know, there are laws and pathways, and different beings can affect that. You know, So today we're actually going right back down to the roots of the world tree of Yggdrasil to take a look at the Norns. So these were very powerful female beings, and they didn't, strictly speaking, predict the future. And that's the thing. They weren't oracles along the lines of Delphi. It was more like if you're familiar with your Greek writings in the history of Greece, the Greek concept of the dictator. So the dictator simply dictated the law that was there. So that's kind of the function and the role that the Norns performed. They said, this is how it is. This is what is set in motion. This is what has come before. And this is all the possibilities that can branch off depending upon the paths that you choose. But as I said, you know, depending, it's like those old adventure books that, you know, were still around when I was a kid, the Choose Your Own Adventure, where, you know, you read so far and then you choose one of your options and go to page such and such turn. That's kind of the concept we're working with here with the Norse beliefs. So these guys, they're known to weave, but when you actually study the older texts, and again, links below the video, me and my PDFs, you know how I am. They're not necessarily referenced as weaving. Like when you study the Greek Fates, the Morai, they're actually described as actually weaving and spinning and cutting the thread. You don't have that same imagery with the Norns. What you do have is they're scoring things on wood. You know, whether it's like little sticks, it's whether it's the tree itself, but they're actually taking sharp tools and inscribing. So it was later on that they kind of built up that association with weaving, and that's kind of what has stuck. So they weave it, they score it, and decree it. From their seat by the sacred well beneath Yggdrasil, they shape Orlog. Now remember, Orlog is like the primal laws for every living being, tending the tree that holds the nine worlds together. They operate with an authority that even the Aesir must respect. And this thing, like even Odin does not fuck around with them. They are not under his jurisdiction as the leader of the Aesir, of the king of Asgard, the way the other gods and goddesses are. Okay. They are kind of completely separate and apart, which is interesting in and of itself. You don't see that very often when you study the different pantheons where you have these outside figures. So if you like I said, if you watched last week's episode on Weird Orlog coming and Filga, this one is building directly off of this. We're zooming out now to a cosmic level, showing who actually spins and maintains these personal threads. We're going to go over who they really were, what we know of their origins, where they hang out, and where they fit in the divine hierarchy, etc. And there's some other kind of fun concepts we're gonna dig into and play with here. So starting out with who the Norns were, origins, hierarchy, location, and cosmic role. So we're gonna go back to where the ancient poets began. All right. So this is again the foot of the world tree of Yggdrasil, which was the great ash that holds the nine worlds in its branches and roots. Like again, you go to the original text, they're described as tucked within the three main branches of roots of Yggdrasil, but as the cultures evolved and adapted, so the iconography did as well. In the oldest surviving visions preserved in the poetic Edda, the Norns are female supernatural beings who rule destiny for gods and humans alike. Now, just a note, by ruling here, they're not dictating in the modern concept of the word dictate, going, no, you're going to do this because I want you to. They're simply stating, no, this is how it is. so they're not casual seers or servants of the Aesir in any way, shape, or form. There's no references in any old texts about people going to them or at any one location, like they went to Delphi to besiege the oracle there. Trying to keep up on the chats. If you guys have questions at any point or want me to pause and go more in depth on any points, you know, just drop it in the chat. I try to keep up. We'll see how much I can ping pong back and forth tonight. Like I said, I've had a lot of coffee. They're basically the ones that are responsible for maintaining the very structure of existence entirely. So without them, everything kind of goes poof. Their origins are ancient, mysterious, and strikingly independent. And again, that's a big one. They're very much apart. The poetic, and specifically the Voluspa, the first book in the Poetic Edda, also known as the CRS's Prophecy, one of the earliest and most profound sources, it paints a very vivid picture of a time before their arrival, which again is interesting. You know, there was a time before them. The gods were described as living in a golden age of innocence and play. And again, for anybody here who's familiar with the Greek stories, they also go over like the golden age and this age and that age and so on and so forth. But just some quotes from the Voluspa referencing that. In their dwellings at peace, they played at tables. Of gold no lack did the gods then know. Till thither came up giant maids three, huge of might, out of Jotunheim. So they're referenced as giant maidens, Jotuns, for coming directly out of Jotunheim. And that's interesting, like especially when you get into the potential scientific ramifications. You know, if anybody's familiar with the archaeology at all, or if now I'd be alone in that nerd, we know this. If you've ever heard of Denisova, okay, we haven't found hardly, I mean, I think we found like some scraps of a finger bone in some snow-encrusted cave somewhere in Siberia. But we do know that there was a humanoid race of the what they call Denisova now, and they were large, basically what we would probably consider giants. I think they've also found potentially found some fragments maybe in China. Don't quote me on that. It's been a very long time since I looked into Denisova specifically. But what's really interesting is a lot of times in the old texts, the Jotuns were said to come from the east. Well, what is east of Scandinavia? Frickin' Siberia. Interesting. It's just interesting. I feel like so many of these stories, you know, that we term mythologies or myths or fairy tales are actually just oral tradition that's passed down. You guys remember playing Whisper Down the Lane as kids, where it's like you whisper and it's like by the time it gets to the end of the line, it sounds nothing like or very little like the original statement made. So yeah, that's, I personally feel that's kind of what happened. These old stories are actually telling us a history as much as they are telling us anything spiritual or religious. Probably more so than the religious. Like, we didn't have a concept of religion back then. That is definitely a more modern thing. So these giant maids, often understood to be the Norns themselves, come from Jotunheim, the realm of the Jotnar, the powerful and primordial beings who represent the wild chaotic forces outside the ordered world of the gods. So these are primal. There's a very primeval aspect to these, more chaotic, natural energy, vril, whatever you want to call it. Very similar in nature. There's a lot of similarities between the Jotuns and the Titans a lot of times. And just the fact that, you know, you have opposite ends of Europe, you know, extreme north and southern end of Europe, and you get stories that they just kind of, they run very much perpendicular to each other. They're Jotuns, Titans, so on and so forth. Again, that it wouldn't stand up in a court of law, but this isn't a court of law. It's the National Socialist Airship, the Salty Bitch, and I get to decide because I'm in charge. So we're going to go with it. Keep losing my place. I'm trying to mark my place when I pause, and it doesn't really help much. So their coming marks the carefree age of the gods, and that it's interesting because, again, they mark the end of the carefree age of the gods, but at the same time, the gods are kind of what brought order to the primordial chaos. So it's kind of that yin and yang. There's a little bit of something in each. The poem suggests this arrival was ultimately for the benefit of humankind, bringing order, law, and the weavings of destiny where none had existed before. So this giantess-like origin is echoed in other early poems. In Vafthrusnismal, hints of primordial female powers tied to fate and the deep roots of the world reinforce the sense that the Norns stand apart or even predate the Aesir Vanir clans of deities. They are not born of the gods, but emerge from the outer realms, bringing with them a wisdom and authority that even Odin must respect and will consult. Like he has to go to them. That's the whole thing with the Voluspa, is he brings up the spirit of one of these Seeresses, and he's like, dude, what's going to happen to me? And that's where we first learn about Ragnarok. Throw Roman upside the head of a nigger baby. Jesus. Filthy says over in FTJ, giants have existed. You know, it's interesting because, you know, we've got stories from like Lovelock Cave out in the American Southwest and, you know, said to have red hair, giants, and you get stories from all different kind of corners of the world. It's so funny, we say corners, but it's like round. Okay, so in the prose Edda, specifically the Gylfaginning, this is where they sort of started systematizing the myths centuries after the fact. And it preserves and expands these older traditions. So Snorri describes a fair hall standing under the ash by the well. And again, this was specifically in the prose Edda. There's no reference to a hall in the poetic Edda. So it's technically not clear whether he just added that in or if it kind of like, again, the story adapted amongst the people to include that and he just documented it, or if it was always there and they just didn't put it down. The poetic Edda, again, it's scraps. It's a goodly chunk of scraps. You know, it's enough to definitely put together, but we don't know what might still be missing from it. So that's a hard one to kind of determine. But so he describes this hall from which three principal maids, Urthr, Verdandi, and Skald, emerge. These maids determine the period of men's lives. We call them Norns. But he is careful to note that there are many Norns. And this is a concept that almost nobody I have ever personally talked to that is familiar even with Scandinavian mythology has heard of before. A lot of people in quote-unquote pagan circles tend to avoid the prose Edda because, oh, Snorri Sturluson was a Christian. So I'm not. He wrote it down. Say thank you, move along. You don't want to read it, don't read it, you know. But it's definitely interesting. So there's not just three, there's many. Now, these would be the three at the top, though. These are the original. These are the primordial. But it is said that some come to every child at birth to shape its life, and that these are of different races. Some are of Aesirkin, some are of Elfkind, some are Dvalin's daughters, dwarves. And if Dvalin sounds familiar, yes, Tolkien literally ripped that one straight out of the Eddas. Good Norns of honorable race grant good lives. Evil Norns bring misfortune. And again, that has interesting implications. That implies a group of women, you know, whether they're Aesir or Vanir or elf or dwarf, you know, they first of all, they are performing tasks. This kind of implies, if not an outright mystery school, but maybe a magical or religious tradition. It would have been a very, very closed tradition, what they call a closed tradition, where unless you're part of it, you know nothing about it. This would not have been spoken of outside of, okay? The fact that they speak about different races is very interesting. One thing that also interested me was, like, apparently they don't mention the Jotuns. Like, there were no other Jotun kind who performed this. The only Jotuns referenced specifically as Norns were the original three. So yeah, and you know, a minor Aesir goddess could also perform a function as a Norn. So this diversity points to something profound about their origins. The Norns are not a single unified family, but a category of powerful female fate shapers that spans the realms, from divine to elven to dwarven kin, and of course that would extend here to Midgard. Okay, Earth, and there would be human women who performed these duties, these tasks. The three great ones at the well may carry the heaviest cosmic burden, yet their power echoes through many beings. Their possible Jotun roots suggest they embody primordial forces older than the Aesir order, forces that the gods themselves had to reckon with when the maidens of huge might stepped outside of Jotunheim. So this is where I start to go, ooh, the possibilities. We do know about some of the what are often termed magical traditions, but they would have actually been more spiritual traditions with like Seidr, Galdr, the Volva, different roles. But nobody's, as far as I know, has really explored the idea that there were women who performed fate shaping. And again, that to me, that just strongly and heavily implies that it just wasn't talked about. This would have been very, very, very sacrosanct, very secretive. Shh, don't talk about it. Don't tell them I'm talking about it, guys. But, you know, as they reference, you know, some came to every child when they were born. So, you know, is this a role that one of the leading matriarchs of a clan would have performed at every new birth? You never know. So where do they fit in the hierarchy of the Aesir? Strikingly, they stand largely outside of it. They are primordial forces parallel to or older than the familiar gods. So even the gods ride every day they ride. I've just lost my place. See, I look up and I lose my place. Every day over Bifrost, the Rainbow Bridge, to hold court at Uthabrunnr, the Well of Urthr, acknowledging a higher framework that governs all. Their location is precise and sacred. Uthabrunnr, getting tongue-tied, beneath the one root of Yggdrasil that reaches towards the realms of the Jotnar, or the deep unknown. Remember, there's three main branches, or root systems that come off the tree. Three has always been a power number, specifically for the Germanic peoples. You see it a lot in all the cultures. When you look at it, it just kind of expresses differently. So you see it in the Celtic. You see it with specifically with the Morrigan is a tripartite goddess. You see Hecate has a tripartite aspect. You have your triads like Zeus, Hera, Athena. In the Roman, it would have been Jupiter, Juno, Minerva. You see three all the time. It is a sacred power number for our people. Every day the Norns drew water from the well, so holy that anything entering it becomes white as the inner film of an eggshell. They mix it with the clay around it and sprinkle it over the tree so its limbs never rot or wither under the strain of the nine worlds. This is a function that not many people seem to want to talk about. They're like, oh, the Norns, they've been largely conflated with the Greek fates. And there's definitely that aspect to what they do. That's a very important aspect of what they do. But I kind of feel like this role that they fulfill of watering the tree, or in this case, you know, they're mixing it with the clay and they're putting it on the roots to protect the world tree is more important. They're literally, the world tree represents the cosmos, right? They're literally the ones holding the cosmos together. And again, that to me, that just makes sense that they would actually delegate and have other women out there doing the everyday tasks. I mean, look at any company, any corporation. You have CEO and the CFO and the COO at top, and they all kind of delegate downwards from there. So to me, that makes sense. But that this is the most important part. And if you think about it, if you look at the Jewish grip, like spiritually, religiously, magically, if you look at the death grip the Jews have had on our connection to our ancestral gods for so long, it just makes so much sense that the world is literally falling apart. Literally falling apart. If there is any truth to this, and our ancestral gods have been locked up, suppressed, put to sleep, whatever you want to call it, and the Norns have not been able to properly perform this function, well, the ramifications there are kind of like, do I need to start building a spaceship and inventing interstellar travel here anytime soon? Conspiracy brain. Specifically, they're caretakers. They are caretakers of the Axis Mundi itself, the weavers who sustain the tree while scoring the fates of all who live within its shadows. So, I mean, just picture it, right? You know, it's this incomprehensibly immense ash tree towering above, its roots plunging into unknown realms from which giant maids once came. And you have your three figures, huge of might yet quiet in their work, and they're drawing this water up, they're scoring staves while the gods themselves come to listen, to observe, to petition. So that is the cosmic stature of the Norns, primordial weavers whose arrival brought structure to chaos and whose hands maintain the tree and whose decrees bind even the Allfather. Space is fake. But is it also gay, Kermie? Is it also gay? That's interesting. And it's one aspect of their importance that, again, even in pagan circles has largely been lost and is never discussed. Oh, they're just weavers of fate. That's all it is. No. It is so much more, my friends. So much more. So that is their level of importance. They're intensely important. I feel like I'm just repeating myself at this point. I love, as I said, the Norns are some of my favorite figures. Absolute favorites. Giant mobile in the sky. Good God. I mean, we'll have to do, you know, is space fake or real in a conspiracy show or something, Kermie, okay? We will do the conspiracy shows, I promise. I'm just trying to figure out how to do them. All right, so now we're going to go over each Norn kind of individually here. Keeping in mind, though, there's not a lot known about them individually, specifically. So, again, dealing with scraps. So, of course, starting off with Urthr, the Norn of what has been. Now, keep in mind, three Norns, it's kind of loosely representative of past, present, future. So just keep that in mind. Urthr, the Norn of what has been. So of the three great Norns, Urthr stands first and oldest, the embodiment of what has already become, the accumulated weight of the past that presses upon every present moment. Her name comes directly from Urthr, the Old Norse word for what has turned out, or fate, or simply that which has happened. You know, we've talked before about how our ancestors, especially the Germanic-speaking ones with the different proto-Germanic languages, it's just like modern German, it's very literal. It's very literal language. It always has been. She's not merely a memory or representative of memory, but of past action specifically that has built things that you use to branch off of. She is the living consequence of every deed, every oath and choice already scored into the fabric of reality. The sources describe the Norns collectively as giant maids of huge might who came out of Jotunheim. So these are very powerful, imposing maidens whose stature and presence mark them as primordial forces far beyond ordinary women. As the eldest, Urthr carries this giantess-like gravity the most heavily. A figure of solemn, unyielding strength and ancient dignity with hands marked by constant labor at the well. In the Völuspá, she is named first among the maidens. Urthr is one named. She is closely tied to the well itself. Urthabrunnr, the well of Urthr, or well of fate. Like it's actually her name. She and the well share a name. And there's symbolism in that. You know, words have power and meaning, and they carry weight. So the fact that it's like she and the well share the same name, they could actually be seen as representative of each other. She is the well as much as she is the caretaker of the well. We've talked before about the personification of these forces. And, you know, this could well be kind of what we're seeing here. She is the possibly a direct personification of the power of the well, or was a not quite so powerful figure who, taking on that role, became personified and influenced and overshadowed by the well. Excuse me. The water drawn from it is so profoundly holy that anything placed within it becomes as white as the inner membrane of an egg. I just thought that was a really, really kind of interesting and fun way to describe it, because that's taken right from the text, specifically the inside of an egg. And I'm sure we've all seen the inside of an egg. I don't know if you've ever tried to peel that membrane out. It's tricky to do. But this kind of speaks to something deeper as well. Like what is an egg, but, you know, a potential new life. Eggs have funny symbolism. It can get very confusing. This well is the reservoir of all that has been. So Orthra's work is steady and foundational. She and her sisters score or carve their decrees onto wood, likely rune staves, wooden slips, or planks, using a sharp tool or knife to incise deep, deliberate marks that fix the unalterable record of what has already come to pass. So this is where I say, you know, fate is fixed, but not fixed. So this is the fixed part. It's already happened. You cannot change it. It is literally carved in wood. That, you know, cannot be altered. There's no going back. There's only going forward. She also participates daily in the maintenance of Yggdrasil, drawing the sacred white water mixed with clay from her well and sprinkling it over the tree's limbs to prevent rot and decay. And, you know, any of our gardening friends in there, I don't know, Filthy, if you're still listening along, you know, I know I've seen similar things done in modern gardening practices where you put different things on trees to kind of protect them. So it's interesting that like we go so far back in our histories and we still see shades of that, you know? But this ensures the past continues to sustain the living structure of the cosmos. We are indivisible from our past, from our origins. It literally shapes everything. Her hands and forearms bail the pale, whitening clay, and her practical heavy garments are often damp at the hem from the constant work at the water's edge. At least that's how I kind of picture her, just based on how her work is described. So spiritually, she is the living heart of Orlog and Weird. She guards and enforces the primal layers that have already been laid down. The deep foundational constitution of events rooted in ancestry and past actions. Every deed a person or family performs thickens the Orlog that Orthra records through her carving. Okay. This, in turn, becomes the weird, the flowing web of consequence that presses upon the present. So when we speak of Haminia, the personal walking luck and ancestral power, it is Orthra's domain that determines how strong or burdened that Haminia arrives to us. So she's not just a caretaker of the well. She's not just a caretaker of the tree. She's also a caretaker of our past, right? Our history. Hey, Edward Snowman, good to see ya. And where was I? Okay. Determines how Haminia arrives. Remember, Haminia is like your personal. Modernly, most people will refer to it as karma, and there are similarities, but there's also a lot of uniqueness there. So a life lived with honor adds positive layers to the Orlog she inscribes. Shame or broken oaths weaken the Haminia, passed to descendants. Orthra teaches that the past is never truly gone. It is the soil and the weight that shapes everything that follows. And, I mean, we all know I believe this stuff, but again, you look at what has been done to our history. And not even just the ancient history, like we go over here on Ash and Ether, but the modern history that, you know, a lot of this stuff, like we go over that a lot in Fash Academy with Professor Fashberg. They have to if they control our history, they're not just controlling the propaganda. They actually kind of have us by the throat in these important cosmic level sort of ways. That's why I stand here and run my mouth about this stuff. Like, I ain't going to shut up. So, you know, it's interesting. It's got a lot of interesting concepts for me. It's hard to dig to. This is one of those topics where it's like you almost want to have, you know, a drink of schnapps or something and sit around in the middle of the night just yapping with somebody about it to really dig into it. Everyone's going to kind of have a personal take on this. Feel free to drop your guys' personal opinions anytime in the chats. I'm just going based off of my research and what I personally feel is right. You know, you get that little click. Does anyone else get that little click in your head where you're thinking through something and you're trying to connect the dots and all of a sudden, you feel this click and yep, that's it. That makes sense. That feels right. So basically Orthra is the anchor in a way, the eldest sister whose quiet carving and tending ensures that nothing truly ever disappears. It only transforms into the threads that bind all of us. And we've all seen the effects losing these threads. Like, you know, how fractured are white people these days, right? Like, can't agree on anything. It's frustrating. All right. Then we come to Verdandi, the Norn of what is becoming. She is a very, very interesting. They're all interesting. I always say that, like, ooh, this one. They all are. So next comes Verdandi, whose name means what is becoming or that which is coming into being. She is the middle sister, the active force in the eternal present, the one who turns potential into unfolding reality moment by moment. So she has an intensely liminal aspect. She's not quite the past. She's not quite the future. She's that nexus point between them. Ever flowing, ever changing, very dynamic. Like her sisters, she belongs to the company of giant maids, huge of might, powerful maidens whose presence carry both wisdom and raw primordial strength. She appears as the most dynamic of the three. So you can think of her as a very vigorous maiden whose movements reflect constant motion, her form strong and graceful rather than rigid. One of the many ways they're often represented is in the classic maiden mother crone motif, obviously with Urthr the oldest as the crone. And then Verdandi would be the mother. You think about it, that kind of makes sense. That tracks on so many levels, but also because mothers are like always in motion, chasing the kids, doing laundry, doing this, doing that. So, I mean, it's not an historically accurate depiction necessarily, but it definitely fits. It makes sense. Like her sister, she belongs... Oh, I went over that. So in the Voluspa listing, she stands between her sisters, so she's in the middle. She's the middle sister. I can relate. So Verdandi is next, is the quote. Together with Urd and Skuld, she scored on the wood. So it's not like they're each like have their own ways of doing, like they kind of share the task. They all kind of come up and score on the wood. Carving or marking the staves that represent lives and laws with a sharp tool. When Urthr anchors the past through her deep inscriptions, Verdandi is the dynamic crossing and braiding of threads right now. In the Helgilays, the Norns are described as braiding strongly the strands of fate, stretching them from east to west and northward to hold forever. Verdandi embodies this active braiding and arranging in the living moment, her fingers moving with the focused energy as the gleaming golden strands are drawn, crossed, and secured between her strong hands. You know, if you get into the weaving imagery, so Urdr would be the one spinning the thread, literally creating the thread from the main source, okay? The one that starts weaving it is Verdandi. She is creating something with this source that is provided to her by her elder sister. She, of course, also joins the daily ritual at the well, drawing the holy water and clay, mixing it, sprinkling it over the tree. There's no real physical descriptions, so you can kind of picture them however you want. It kind of sucks, but at the same time, I don't know that there were ever actual physical descriptions. I just dropped my pen. Of course I did. Good thing I have a highlighter here. I don't know if there ever would have been. Again, they're thought to at least come from outside of the realm of the gods, possibly even predating it. So I just don't know that there ever would have been an actual description of them anywhere. Spiritually, Verdandi is the bridge between Urlog, okay, so the primal laws, and Weird, the active component of that. The place where Haminya is tested and shaped in real time. She is the eternal present where the primal layers laid down by Urlog meet the flowing web of Weird. Every loom and I'm sorry, every decision made in the now, every act of courage, generosity, or honor crosses new threads on her loom and strengthens or weakens the personal hymenia that walks with a person. So while Urdhra records what has already become, Vedanti is where we actively participate in the weave. This is where that choose your own adventure book concept comes in. So depending on what you do, she goes, okay, I guess we're taking this thread and running it across that way. I wouldn't have picked that one, but oh well, this guy did. This is where we start to impact the weave. She shows that even with the strong framework of fate, our choices in the living moment help determine how heavily or lightly the threads of weird press upon us, and how brightly our hymenia shines for ourselves and our descendants. Remember, just because this is our present, at some point, our actions now are going to become that past, that orlog, that source for our descendants. That is why what we do in the now is so, so important, especially right now with everything going on. And that's really all there is on her. Unfortunately, I wish there were more, but these are very much conceptual in a way. And that brings us to the third sister, the third Norn, Skald. Sometimes I've seen it written as Skaldi, the Norn of what shall be. And she is the youngest and often thought to be the most formidable. So Skald, also just like kind of a cool name. I actually almost went with that name instead of non-kosher salt. So, like, you could all be talking to Skaldi instead of Salty, but I kind of like Salty. I'm glad I went with that. So, her name here actually derives from the verb skulu, shall or must, carrying strong connotations of debt, obligation, and necessity. She represents what shall be, the future that is owed, the consequences that must come due. She carries a sharper, more urgent presence than her sisters. She's known as the youngest maiden, so you could kind of picture her as, I wouldn't picture some like scrawny little teenager, but like a young woman. And that's how I kind of see them, as like, you know, badass granny, and that don't fuck with her mama, and that budding warrior maid is kind of how I picture them. But she definitely, what we know of her, there's an intensity to Skald that hints at her Valkyrie role. We do know a little bit. She's at least attested more than the others because of this role. So she has a lot of moving around. Sometimes she's carving final marks with a sharp tool, sometimes braiding threads with a tighter, more binding tension. In the Voluspa, she is named last, Skald the Third. The prose edda adds that Guthr and Rota and the youngest Norn, she who is called Skald, ride ever to take the slain and decide fights. There is a list, and I can't remember which part of the edda it is in, where they actually name, I think it's like 13 Valkyries. Now, that's not necessarily like, oh, there's only 13, but 13 named Valkyries, and Skald is on that list. So it's interesting that she has sort of a dual role in that capacity. And it's in this role that her work takes on a more active, almost martial edge. She helps choose the slain on the battlefield, enforcing the future through war and death. Well, the Valkyries technically didn't enforce it. They just chose the ones that were taken to either Odin or Freya. So she also participates in the sprinkling of the water and clay, as well as the scoring of the runes. But her contribution feels charged with forward momentum, ensuring the tree's endurance so that the future can arrive as decreed. In the Helgi lays, the Norn's braiding of golden threads reaches far, fixing the hero's fate across lands, with Skald's influence felt in the binding necessity of what shall be. Again, no physical descriptions. I always kind of picture her as a brunette for some reason. I don't know why. Don't ask. Spiritually, she embodies the forward pull of Orlog and the final accounting of Weird, while directly shaping the inheritance of Haminya. Because remember, Haminya can be inherited. That's kind of the whole point of it, honestly. She is the Norn of necessity, the debt that must be paid when the primal layers laid down by Orlog reach their due date. She enforces the weird that flows from past actions, often with the sharp finality of a battle or a life's end. Yet she also determines how the Haminya, that personal reservoir of luck and ancestral power, is passed forward. A life met with courage and honor under Skald's gaze can leave a stronger Haminya for descendants, even when the threads themselves are difficult. She reminds us that while we cannot escape what shall be, the way we meet it becomes part of the Orlog our children will inherit and the Haminya that will walk beside them. She marks the final threads or ties them tight when the obligation comes due. One way I always think of Skald, not so much just that which has yet, how do they phrase that? What shall be, I also think of her as that which has not yet come to pass. So again, there's a lot of fluidity to her, not necessarily in the fluidity of motion, that dynamic motion that we see with Radandi, but true fluidity as in it can kind of go any which way, depending on your actions. You know, it's, I'm trying to think how best to describe the concept. I can't think of it. I had a really good analogy, and it just went, I think I've had too much coffee at this point, quite honestly. And as I said, unfortunately, there's just not, outside of these few attestations in the Eddas and other lays, there's just not that much known. So a lot of this, keep in mind, is very much extrapolated. But when you kind of look at it circumstantially, there it is again, that circumstantial evidence, and do the comparison with what we know of other cultures and their versions of this, like the Greek fate specifically, you can draw a lot of correlations and kind of fill the gaps in, kind of like they did in Jurassic Park with the frog DNA to make the dinosaurs work. So it's hard piecing it together. It's one thing that's interesting to me is, like, we can't track some of my family sides very far back at all, honestly. And it's like, I sometimes sit and wonder, like, wonder what Haminya was passed down. What am I dealing with? What am I going to be surprised with today? It'll take a lot more meditation than I have the time and, quite honestly, the patience for to figure that out. One second, guys. I'm getting dry mouth. Oh, I don't know, Filthy. Filthy says there's no such thing as too much coffee, but quite honestly, the older I get, the more my stomach is like, bitch, you better stop. You need some water that hasn't been superheated and filtered through ground coffee beans. All right, so next section, Norns in the Human World, Births, Sagas, Overlaps, and Questions of Worship. Okay, so were the Norns worshipped? That's kind of the big question. So the Norns' work was not technically confined to the cosmic well. They, or their lesser kin, entered the human realm directly, especially at the moment of birth. So in the Helgi lays of the Poetic Edda, we get one of the most vivid scenes. Night has fallen in the homestead when the Norns arrive to shape the newborn hero Helgi's fate. It was night in the homestead. The Norns came. Those who had shaped fate for that noble one, they said he would become the most famed of warlords and be thought the best of princelings. They braided strongly the strands of fate, shook up the stronghold in Braulund. They arranged the golden threads and fixed them in the middle under Moon's Hall. They hid the ends to east and west. There the Lord would hold land between. One sister stretched a thread northward, bidding it hold forever. And that sort of east-west thing is interesting, but even more interesting is tying it also to the north specifically. And remember, north was sacred to specifically our Scandinavian ancestors. I'm loving the nicer weather. My allergies are not. So this is kind of showing east west. That to me is indicative of the lifespan, especially because a lot of the ancient cultures saw the West as kind of like the land of the dead or the afterlife. We went over that in our afterlife series, right? Where there was a lot of association with the West, but in the Scandinavian, there was also afterlife associations in the North, but they were more specifically tied to the Aesir. So what's interesting here is they're kind of implying with that thread stretch northward that there is divine influence to some extent, lesser or greater. I'm not entirely sure. I need to really reread Helgi's Lay specifically. It, for some reason, this makes me think a little bit about Hercules. You know, he was a demigod, yeah, and then Helgi wasn't, but you also have that kind of connection to the realm of the gods, sort of. So the Norns spin golden threads that reach to the halls of the gods, a sign of destined greatness, yet the scene carries the shadow of tragic necessities that will later unfold. This motif repeats in other heroic births. The Norns arrive, pronounce Orlog, and depart, leaving the child and family to live out the weave. In the sagas, such visitations underscore that even the greatest heroes operate within threads already scored. The Norns sometimes overlap with Valkyries, specifically with Skald riding to choose the slain, and with Sather. Okay, Sather magic is a whole specific practice. Where vulvas might glimpse or subtly influence the pattern through trance and prophecy. The prose Edda emphasizes variety. Not all Norns are the same. As we referenced earlier, some can be Aesir, some can be Elf, some can be Daughters of the Dwarves. Good Norns of honorable race grant good lives, others bring hardship. And that because, my friends, like, if you want to call it magic, if you want to call it real, whatever you want to call it, it's a tool. Just like anything else. You know, when discussing quote unquote magic with people, a lot of times they get really confused. Like, well, isn't magic evil? I'm like, well, is a gun evil? You know, a gun in the hand of a good guy is going to do good things. A gun in the hand of a bad guy is going to do bad things. It's a tool just like anything else. It's all in how it is used. So like that moral good or bad, you know, who's doing good things, who's doing bad things. It's all down to the individual person. And it does kind of drive home the lesson of if you have different skills, you want to use them for the good of your people, obviously, not the bad. So this diversity reflects the full spectrum of fate, not uniformly kind, but balanced in consequence. As far as active worship goes, the ancient texts are strikingly silent. Like, bubkis, there's nothing. There's no reference to this whatsoever. Nowhere do we find descriptions of dedicated Nornablot temples or priestesses serving the Norns alone. No place names honor them specifically, unlike the abundant evidence for Thor, Freya, or Odin. People spoke of the Norns' decree with fatalistic respect, but offerings and oaths went primarily to the Aesir and the Vanir. The gods themselves rode to the well to take counsel, yet they did not build hofs to the Norns. They're so powerful. They're so powerful and independent and outside the structure of the Aesir, of the gods themselves, that like you don't even worship them. And my personal thoughts on it are, well, you can't really bargain with fate. So why bother petitioning it? It's set in stone. You know how much impact you can have. Just conduct yourself honorably, and that's about it. so what's the point? What's the point? It's not going to change just by offering it, you know, a horn of mead or a nice meal or incense or prayer. It is what it is. You're not going to change it through those metrics. The only change you can enact is through your own personal deeds and actions and how you conduct yourself. And even then, it's still going to be a narrow trajectory by which you can potentially shift things. Just my thoughts on the matter. Yeah, their power was so fundamental. Above bargaining, that perhaps no formal cult was needed. And I do think that is true. I really do. The entire cosmos was already their shrine. We're basically living in their house, y'all. Indirect reverence may have existed through well offerings, Seder rituals, seeking glimpses of the weave, or honoring fate during births and name givings. But direct worship like that given to the gods appears absent, completely absent in the surviving sources. And again, that's kind of the nub of the matter in surviving sources. There may have been, but if there was, it was in the distant enough past that there is absolutely no surviving record. So it probably predated any kind of writing, even potentially, if it was there. The work was maintenance and decree, sustaining the tree, scoring the fates within it. So in that in that sense, the Norns didn't need a temple. They are literally woven into everything. Their impact is in every single thing. You know, if you wanted to maybe incorporate veneration to the Norns modernly, honestly, just taking care of things around you. Like I said, they're in everything. What we're all doing here, and I don't mean specifically in Ash and Aether. I mean being involved in this movement scene, whatever the hell you want to call it, being aware of the problem that is the Jews and all the other Nons, and doing our small part. I think of this way: there is no small part. There is absolutely no small part. Everything we do, whether it's dropping memes on X that might wake somebody up, wake up the next person, it's all contributing to correcting something that has gone badly wrong with the weave. So don't ever think that, you know, just sitting around posting memes or chatting in chat, that has a much bigger impact than I think anybody realizes, quite honestly. We are all working towards a goal. Just the fact that we are all thinking about, like, the very power of thought, because thought can shift your will, and your will can be very, very, very powerful. Okay, getting off my soapbox. Which that's kind of a nice segue, though, into the potential for earthly Norns, mortal women as extensions of the divine weavers. So the idea of many Norns of different races opens a fascinating door. Could some mortal women have acted as earthly extensions of or reflections of the Norns' power? My opinion, absolutely, 100%. In later legendary sagas, such as Nornagest's, something I can't read because it's in weird letters, the term Norn or Norna appears almost interchangeably with the word vulva. Now, the vulva were not witches. A lot of people are like, oh, that was just a Scandinavian word for witch. Technically not. Very different meanings. Vulva were traveling seeresses and Seder practitioners. Yes, there would have been different levels and different skill sets. Analogy, me and my analogies. You can be in medicine, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be able to perform a surgery. Maybe you're a dermatologist, right? So you would have had some that were skilled in Seder, some that were skilled in herbcraft, some that were skilled in so on and so forth. There's a lot of different components and moving parts to that. When Norns arrived at a hero's birth to shape his destiny, they are sometimes described more like powerful wise women than purely supernatural beings. My personal opinion, maybe you have a bachelor's, you have a master's, and some people have PhDs, right? So I think it's probably, it was like a ranking. So you had someone that started out at a vulva, they became a sederkona, and they finally achieved that upper mastery level that would have been to be a Norn. So my two cents. In Rolf's saga, Norns are even portrayed with a darker edge. We do have some documentation of where they said, you know, evil Norns. They're depicted as malevolent witches or fate workers aligned with elves or other forces. And just a side note there, you know, we all know they reference elves quite often in the different sagas and stories, but there were light elves and there were dark elves. And that's a whole thing for a whole separate episode all of its own. So we're not going to get into that, but there were light and dark elves. This blurring makes sense. Vulvas carried staffs reminiscent of the Norns' tools for scoring or weaving fate. They entered trance states to prophesy, heal, curse, or influence outcomes, actions that echoed the Norn's decree of Orlog. A skilled vulva might be seen as temporarily channeling or interpreting the greater weave, especially during births, name-givings, or times of crisis. So the different races of Norns mentioned in the Prose Edda, you know, Aesir, Elf, etc., could hint at this spectrum. You know, instead of other different races, the way we modernly think of races, it could have denoted either different subspecialties or different levels of mastery. Okay, I don't think the Keebler elves really count. Interesting concept, though. Now I'm picturing a Keebler elf all done up in, like, ritual garb. Thanks, Filthy. Okay, so they entered a trance state to prophesy, heal, curse, or influence outcomes, actions that echoed the Norn's decree of Orlog. A skilled vulva might be seen as temporarily channeling or interpreting the greater weave. Oh, I read that. So some Norns might have been understood as human women of special talent or spiritual calling, while others belong to otherworldly kin. And again, that's just going to depend on your own personal spin on that, whether you think there actually were elves and dwarves and such running around on Midgard at any certain point in history. In a society where women managed households, preserved lore, and practiced Seder, the boundary between Divine Weaver and Mortal Seeress was likely very, very porous, very thin. Hey, Snail Racer, good to see you. The earthly Norns would not replace the cosmic three, but extend their influence into daily life, advising the Jarls, foretelling harvests or battle outcomes, and helping individuals navigate their personal threads. They were revered, sometimes feared, and often rewarded with hospitality and gifts, much like the vulva Thorbjörg in Eric's saga. I think I have the link for Eric's saga in there as well. So in this light, every wise woman who reads the signs, spins prophecy, or helps shape a child's path became a living thread in the greater tapestry. So a mortal echo of the maidens mighty in wisdom who worked beneath the tree. And when you put it into that context, pretty much every woman takes on some task of the Norns. We are predominantly, especially historically, the ones that not just give birth to the children, we are the ones most active in the day-to-day raising of them, you know, at least up until a certain age. Okay, so we are impacting their threads, right? We are teaching them how to operate within those threads, within that weave, that web. We fulfill, you know, they come at the birth. Who historically, again, would always attend women in childbirth were other women. You could make the argument that every woman has some aspect of the Norns to her, you know, and it makes you wonder if that's some of the reason, amongst many reasons, the Jew, and we know my thoughts on this, I firmly blame the Jew for the quote-unquote witch hunts. This, I think, was one of the reasons why they went specifically after women as practitioners of evil magic. We have this aspect to us. It's just part of who we are. It's part of our literal biological makeup, our spiritual makeup. And they had to break that. They had to brainwash it right out of us. And it's something I would hope every woman would be able to reconnect to, because we're going to need it. We're going to need that spiritual backup, you know? It's all well and good to sit there and say, oh, it's God's fight, but God helps those that help themselves too. You know, and that's the thing. You know, my gods teach me to, you carry your own load. You have an impact. You impact what happens for yourself, for your family, for your clan, your folk. You know, it is incumbent on all of us to contribute, to try and make good impact, build stronger Orlog for our future generations. I feel like I'm preaching now to the choir. I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you think, you know, that there might have been this whole component of women acting as spiritual Norns here on Midgard? I kind of do. Waiting on the lag. Yeah, and like I said, unfortunately, there's not much actually known. So we can talk a lot about the concepts and the ideas and our own thoughts and theories. Unfortunately, there's not a lot actually laid down, which is the hard part. Let's see. Oh, my mouse fell asleep. That's how you know it's been a good. Let me actually turn that off. I know. Yes and no, as far as in terms of its similarity to the Oracles of Delphi. In as far as there was some prophetic component, yes, there is a surface similarity. The Oracles of Delphi, though, they simply got glimpses into what would have been a fairly immediate future. Whereas Norns, there was a lot more going on. There was a lot more going on. Now, I haven't done the deep dive on the Oracles of Delphi specifically, but it was a more active... Oh, dear God. You had to put that picture up. I don't know how you catch me in the craziest poses unobtrusive. but yeah, the Norns were a much more active force. Okay, so active in their caretaking of the well and of the tree, active in their scoring and laying down of Orlog, the primal laws, of actually shaping the weave and web of weird. Much more of a dynamic force. Instead of simply giving out glimpses, they are actively shaping. they're actively shaping things to some extent. Without an agenda. Like that's a big confusion a lot of people have. It's not like Odin could not go to the Norns and go, you know what? Fuck that guy down there in Norway. I don't like him. I want you to fuck up his Hamingja. It didn't work that way. As I said at the beginning, they were kind of dictators of, and not dictators as in, you know, I'm in charge, but simply dictating to people, no, this is how it was, this is how it is, and now here's the ways that it could be, depending on your own actions. So in that way, they're more guardians, they're caretakers, and shapers to some extent, but not in, at least not when you get to the actual cosmic, the actual three original Norns, the OG Norns. There were no agendas. Now, again, you know, as discussed with potential human women fulfilling that role. Oh, my God, you guys. yes, of course, every human being, no matter how highfalutin they think their morals are, there's usually agendas. We all have agendas. Everybody sitting here tonight has an agenda. You know, we see our agenda as very positive. You know, the Jew would actually argue with us, but fuck them. We don't like them anyway. They have their agenda. And that's the whole problem with good, evil, right, and wrong, is it's become so muddled in our modern times that most people see it as subjective. And it's not that it's subjective. It just depends on your perspective. You know? It gets very philosophically complicated. That's why, like, I have people, you know, come to me like, hey, you know, how do I learn to do magic? And I always go, don't. Just don't. You'll fuck it up. And usually the person you're going to end up hurting is yourself. because people always go in with an agenda. They always go in with an agenda. And that's just, like I said, it gets complicated. That being said, you know, you can incorporate aspects of this, though, as I said, into your everyday life. We're all doing it right now. And we're doing it kind of unconsciously. We know we're doing something regarding National Socialism and white power and Aryan unity. Most people don't realize the further reaching implications of that, though. Aw, thanks, unobtrusive. I love you guys, too. Extreme dry mouth. So, you know, maybe that's, hey, maybe I'll actually give homework. You know, as you're going out and about, you know, whether it's dropping memes, having interactions with people IRL and planting seeds, just kind of add an extra 3 seconds of thought as to what you would like to see as a next step for the person you're interacting with. Like, okay, I'm talking to this person and it seems like they're really in tune with economics. So let me drop some economic points about National Socialism. And you know what? I'm going to wish that they were hope that they or intend that they would go actually look up the economic plans of the Third Reich. And just start to put that energy out there, that vril. We all have it. Aww. It's suggested homework. Okay, you don't have to. Listen, you don't have to worry about actually doing what I say unless I'm swinging a pirate sword around. All right? That's all I'm saying. But no, just a little more intentionality, conscious intentionality is a good thing. We all, myself foremost and certainly included, we're very emotional on this topic. And that's good. We should be. We should be emotional about that. It's natural for us to be emotional about it. But sometimes if you can kind of take just a mental half step back and just kind of try and see just a little further where that meme might land, who that phrase might impact. If that's a little too, you know, woo-woo new age for you guys, just think of it as tactical. It's tactical, it's strategic. There, see, I made it better. Eleven acres of toil and turmoil. Yeah. Chains caught and getting tangled. There we go. So that's kind of, I know I've got I've got the Poetic Edda. There's something from Gutenberg. Prose Edda. There's all the usual PDFs down there. Let's see. Let's open them up. Let's go through them. Open in a new tab. Share the screen. There we go. I was having a hard time finding my original link. So some of these aren't the best. They're actually scanned books. Just remember the main sites. Aw, thank you, Edward Snowman. He says, thank you for your great content and made a very generous donation. You guys. You guys are the best. This one was cool. Usually I try and stay away from the scanned books because they can be harder to read. But this one was just fun because it was like a real old copy. I forget when this one came out, but 1923 by the American Scandinavian Foundation. So that's the Prose Edda. Okay, what else did we have? Norns. Oh, okay. This was Project Gutenberg. Here you actually have one where you can click and you can read now, or you can download. So I'm trying to give more options for you guys if you want to, like, the instant bring it up and read it, if you want one that you can download and read offline. Let's see. What else did I have? Prose Edda. Whoops. Would help if I were on the right frickin' tab now, wouldn't it? I almost had a whoopsie. No more whoopsies. I'm done with whoopsies for a while. Okay, so I got the Prose Edda, and I think that was another Gutenberg version of... Let's check this one out. If it wants to load, it likes to take its time. It really does. Okay, you know what? We'll just bring that up in a different tab. In a different tab. Norns... Okay, here we go. Screen. Yes, yes, share. Eric the Red Saga by John Sefton. An historical account that appears to have been written in the late 19th century, so late 1800s. This book chronicles the life and explorations of Eric the Red, a Norse explorer known for discovering Greenland, and his son, who is arguably a little more famous, Leif Erikson. subsequent expedition to Vinland, which is believed to be part of North America. And we know they have actually found Scandinavian settlement in Newfoundland, Canada, specifically. So this one, you know, is just, it's fun. And they got all sorts of, you know, you can click read now. You can send to Kindles or older e-readers, older Kindles, plain text, and a download. Just that way everybody can kind of pick their poison book-wise. And then we've got, again, if it loads, it's the Froggy Mater non-GMO Kermie. again, another scanned book, but it was kind of a cool find. Stories and Ballads of the Far Past, Cambridge University Press, 1921. So a lot of these are just really cool sources. Someday I will have enough room to actually have a physical library of all of these. Somewhere Arian Eagle is twinging going, what do I have to build now? Internet Archives, Rolf's Saga was another good one. This one I think you have to actually log in to borrow, but you just need the free account for it. So that was a good one. And I do also, down below the video, I have a couple of video links I put up. Organic Hermato, oh geez. So let's bring these up. We're not going to watch these just because, well, this one's like 18 minutes. Now, we've looked at this guy's YouTube page before, and we also look at his store. This is Norse Magic and Beliefs. Really, really good guy. He really does his really good research. As far as I can tell, he is not one of us. He's not a nationalist. But he definitely knows what he's talking about this. So I have a video of his linked below where he goes over the three Norns of fate in Norse mythology and also gives sources and archaeological evidence. That's a very good watch. I know I've watched that one a couple different times, and it's very, very good. And then we also have – I looked for something by Survive the Jive, and I didn't find anything specifically on the Norns. Now, he references them in some of his bigger videos that he's done, his longer videos. This is that other guy I mentioned last week, Arith Hodiger. He's not really a personality. It was very hard to find anything out about him. A lot of what he puts out, you know, the research is quality. I'm not going to stand behind him as far as, like, honestly, he looked like a Jew just a little bit. Let's see if we can... See, I don't know. What do you guys think? Potentially. It's hard to tell. I have a hard time telling sometimes, especially when there is facial hair involved. It's hard to see the full shape of the face. But I used to watch his videos all the time, and I rewatched them before this episode, and they are, information-wise, they're pretty sound. They're as sound as I can find. Again, it's hard because the Norns, there's just not a lot known about them. There's not a lot of attestations. Now, he's coming at, like, this video is specifically more like a runic divination method called the Three Norns method. So it's not specifically about the Norns, but for anybody who's interested in working with the runes, well, I found this spiffy video that kind of segues right into it. So, I mean, and you can always do a generic Google search on the Norns. Just, you know, be careful with your sourcing. If it's any kind of like neo-pagan, stand back a little ways. If it says Wiccan, throw something at it. Point and laugh. Ha ha. I don't like that. I know. That's not very unity-minded of me, but I've had, believe me, the so-called Wiccan community out there is about as leftist degenerate as it comes anymore. It's bad. It's bad, you guys. Trust me on this. Just take my word for it. It's bad. Don't go there. So that's pretty much what I had for sources. I didn't want to overlay with too many links. And again, it was harder to find videos specifically about the Norns. I know I found more for last week's episode about, you know, Weird Orlog and all that. There's just more written about it. So there's more work and study done on it. So yeah, that's where we're at for tonight. No overtime tonight, guys. My voice is starting to give out. Definitely check out the sources. If you have any questions, comments, or whatnot, you've got like 12 minutes to get it in. The blue-haired dykes. Oh, no. It's not just blue. Rainbow hair. Green hair. No hair. Crazy chicks with shaved heads. Edward Snowman says, hey, ladies, I don't know how to sugarcoat this, but we area men are going to need your help with L because L always wins until we are all gone. Oh, believe me, Edward, believe me. Preaching to the choir. I say that all the time, especially to some of my interactions on the interwebs at large, like I'm thinking X specifically, where, you know, you've got men basically saying, get the fuck back in the kitchen. You don't belong on the internet. You're a woman. And I'm like, I mean, I got some really sharp knives in my kitchen. I don't mind going and grabbing them. Hold still. Don't move. I'll be right back. And I've talked about this before. When Hitler was first voted into power, it was with the backing of 3 million German women that voted for him. If for no other reason, especially those that are like, women don't belong doing this. Women don't belong. I'm sorry, we don't have the numbers. We don't have the numbers. Just from a tactical viewpoint, women have got to get, and we are. We are seeing a lot more women start to speak out, step up, and right now it's a little bit of like a free-for-all, but we're coming up with ideas on helping other women get organized. So we have effective effort being put forth, and it's not everybody just running around like chickens with their heads chopped off. But yeah. One area, and some of my earlier Lost episodes from the very, very beginning of my streaming career, that was one of the things I did. I would go over some of the historical roles of women, and spiritual leadership was traditionally as much, if not more so, a woman's domain. And that carried over for quite a long time. You figure, even up until the Middle Ages, Hildegard von Bingen, she was a very, very powerful nun and abbess. And like even the Pope was like, she's pretty tough. Don't mess with her. I did a whole episode about her, I think. I don't know if that one was lost. That one might be lost. But like this is a role we've always fulfilled, and we need to see women getting more involved again. It's hard to know how to move forward sometimes. There's so much going on that you kind of go, I have to take it. No, I got to go take care. No, I got to. It all seems to be coming on at once. So it's hard to figure out the best trajectory. At least that's one thing I struggle with. It's like it's kind of taken a while to kind of fine tune what I do. Aw, thank you, Kermie. Kermie says, grateful for this show and its whole crew. Me three. I love all you guys. Feeling a little sentimental tonight, you guys. I don't know why. Is that a full moon? I feel like it might be a full moon. I should know that. Well, what do you think? Should we do something about astrology at some point? I've kind of left that one alone because, by and large, I don't buy into astrology. I don't. I've known people who are all, you know, self-proclaimed pagans who are all like, well, you can't do this ritual or that worship because, you know, such and such isn't aligned with so-and-so. And I'm like, so? If we waited for perfect alignments, we'd never get anywhere. It you know, just another great analogy for this movement. If we wait for perfect conditions to push forward, we're just going to die on the ground. So is what it is. All right, guys. I am going to get ready to cue up our outro music, figure out what I want. While that is warming up, give a shout out to everybody in the chats over here on 88. We had Arian Eagle, Conservative, Kermie, Tango Alpha Vector. I think that was pretty much it. Possibly some lurkers. It's okay. We like lurkers too. L, the mother to end all mothers, quite literally. Not a friend to mom and the mom within others. Okay. Yeah. L, that makes me... That was like Middle Eastern, right? L. Not up on that stuff. It's one of those where it's like I really need to read up on that stuff, and I just Makes me feel kind of gross. All right. Anybody listening along on Crewbot, thanks for listening in. Always good to have you. And over here in FTJ, we had Whitman, Thomas E. Dwyer, Arian Eagle, The Woodsman, Snail Racer, Kermie, Unobtrusive, and Edward Snowman. Whoops. Almost had a whoopsie there. And then I did just want to do an extra thank you to Whitman, Edward Snowman, and Kermie for your generous support. You guys are awesome. You're all sorts of awesome. I appreciate each and every one of you. Scroll past the crazy pictures of me. Kermie likes the idea of astrology, but in a scientific framing. Could be something as simple as prevalence and aspects of sperm production. Okay. The goddess of unjust torture and child sacrifice. Okay. Okay. Now I remember the one you mean, yeah. I think I've heard her referenced in other names, but yeah, I know the one you mean now, N-word. yeah, definitely bad news bears. Definitely bad news bears. That's just another quick side note. That is some of the problem. Our ancestral gods have been suppressed for minimum over 1,000 years, minimum, probably closer to 1500 to 1800 years. And the Semitic gods are not, I should say demons. They may not be forward facing with it, but you really think they're not worshiping them in their synagogues? You really think they're not praying to them, invoking them, bringing their powers forth into this plane of existence? They absolutely are. They absolutely 100% are. And that's one of the reasons why I do this show, because by ourselves, we're not going to be able to combat that. Making different types of babies at different times of the year. Oh, my God. There's some truth to that, though, too. And there you go. Astrology was an early form of personality tests, like the INJF or whatever the hell it is. What do you guys want to listen to for a play-out song? Should I pick something random? I feel like I should just pick something random. Do we want something pagan-y? Do we want something power metal? I could play classical music. I'm kind of up for anything. Let's see. I'm not even sure what I want to listen to. I don't know. This is one of those nights where I'm kind of like all over the place. Like, you should have seen the musical options I went through before I'd settled on Tear for pre-show. Okay. Well, I don't know. I think we'll just go with this one, guys. Corrosion of Conformity, Vote with a Bullet. All right. Not usually my cup of tea, but Corrosion of Conformity. Don't say I don't like you guys. Don't love you guys. Vote with a Bullet. All right, we'll get this queued up. Let me share my screen here. And if you hate the song, blame Kermie. All right, guys. Until next time, white fucking power and total Aryan victory.